between that and Lost, I was just like, please just take a shit in my mouth. I'll accept that more than you dicking me around for 5 years and then doing this to me.
Radio Drone.
Welcome to another wasted 55 minutes on a Thursday night. I'm Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is Cecil T. Robot.
Si, senor.
Who has apparently got the Mexican settings turned on. And Alex will not be joining us this week, but our old friend and Rhodes Scholar himself, the guru of film, the man who runs the projection booth, Mike White, is here with us. Did I suck your dick enough on that one, Mike?
I co-run it. I'm not the big cheese. I'm half of the cheese.
Fine, fair enough.
Swiss cheese?
Yes.
No, this is a show for Americans, damn it. You are American cheese, maybe cheddar.
Merkin cheese.
Merkin, bitch. It tastes like cigarette smoke and meth. Let's get the Adam and Eve promo out of the way. Go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code DROME to get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, and free U.S. shipping. That shipping to U.S. is free. Screwed that up, but we'll see. What I wanted to talk about tonight was what kind of shifted in, when I use the term genre, I'm talking sci-fi, fantasy, horror, etc., how it used to be seen as, you know, that kid's stuff. Like in the movies, you didn't have serious science fiction films very often in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then when Star Wars hit, it became more acceptable to the mainstream, and then it dipped back again. And then now with comic book movies, like being a geek is totally in now. Why do you think the genre in general keeps changing?
Well, I would think that actually a little bit before Star Wars, I would think that 2001 kind of helped bring a lot of legitimacy to the genre, and that it had been seen as kind of Buck Rogers-ish and everything, probably more by the mainstream. But I mean, it was really kind of a haven for a lot of intellectuals. There was a lot of great writing going on. I mean, the 50s and 60s were filled with wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean, the 40s as well, but I mean, really, you had kind of a terrific time for science fiction, especially the writing and a lot of the different media. I mean, I'm all about the, you know, rocket men on the moon kind of stuff. So I was
I love that old pulp stuff too.
Yeah, I was happy to go back and see that. 2001 probably brought it out of the ghetto a little bit and more into the mainstream. Took it from that, you know, George McFly reading comics, in the privacy of his own room, to kind of being more of something that was acceptable. And I don't know if that was, you know, drug culture that helped that, or if it was just kind of more of
maybe
the,
you got to be high to accept the aliens, man.
Well, you know, it was quite a big thing to line up for those last 30 minutes of 2001, and it was definitely one of the first, you know, quote unquote head movies. So folks were really into that kind of stuff. And then after that, I mean, we did have quite a renaissance. I mean, there was still cheese galore. Yeah, after that, I mean, you were able to kind of mix your bigger ideas with your science fiction a little bit more out in the open, as it were. So you could do a Silent Running, which God knows I would never go back and watch that movie again, but you could do boring science fiction.
Joan Baez on the soundtrack.
Oh, God. Yeah. I don't know. I've tried to watch that movie so many times, and just every time I'm like, God, this is boring as hell. But I don't know. Did I answer the question?
Yes.
I think in general, it's the a lot of the movies and stuff, I would say not so much the books and everything, but I mean the general public, the perception of science fiction was kid stuff, because a lot of what was being portrayed was Flash Gordon and, you know, serialized fiction that was done very cheesy and very cheaply, And so there was just this idea that, you know, that stuff's for kids. And then again, I don't, you know, like Mike said, I don't know if it was 2001, but that seems like it probably would have been a good point of when it was like, oh, wait, we can have a story that is like really serious and engaging.
I'm going to stop you there. 2001 doesn't have a story. It's not engaging, and it might be adult science fiction, but it's an art house film that has no story or characters.
Well, it definitely has a story. I mean, yes. The whole idea of the aliens giving us the monolith and that kind of being the signal, the signpost that we're ready to move on to the next generation, you know, leaving it on the moon and that pointing the way to Jupiter and then going out there to the next barrier. So I definitely see that there's quite a story to the film.
That takes up about 20 minutes of the 2.5 hour runtime. I'm sorry, yeah. I hate 2001. It's one of the most... Mike, you couldn't get through Silent Running again? I think 2001 is one of the most pretentiously boring films I've ever sat through.
I like it.
And that's fine. You can like it. I'm not disparaging you for liking it. I'm just saying I don't. I disagree with Cecil on that.
No, it's fine. I can. It's one of those movies where, yes, I can understand people not liking it because it is slow and it is... If you're into it, then you are full on into it. But if you just aren't really into that kind of thing, if you know, I mean, because it is, I agree, it is an art house film. It's an art house film that I think is, it works, and it is one of those pivotal moments in cinematic history where they did things differently and it changed the way that, you know, films were being made for a while. So, I mean, there is a good possibility that movies like Star Wars and whatnot may not have been able to be greenlit if not for 2001 coming along. But I think that when you look back on it now, it is very slow and just not as engaging as some things are now. But then there are stuff now that everybody talks about how much they love, and it's, oh God, it's just, it everything happens and it's great. And that I find boring because they try too hard to keep your attention. And by doing that, they lose me because they just shove too much at you. And it's just like, I don't give a crap about any of this. So going back to what the original question was, mainstream audiences started looking at science fiction differently because that was such a serious production as opposed to the kind of swashbuckling kiddie stuff that we had gotten prior.
Well, for instance, and I can't disagree with you on the 2001 being kind of the shifting point, because just the year prior, you had Barbarella, a movie that is pretty goofy, pretty over the top, and pretty ridiculous. And then you had 2001, and it sort of changed everything. But then you had this dip again in the 90s where sci-fi was goofy again. So why do you think it goes generationally? Like the people that grew up watching Tarantula on the late night movie, that they're the ones who said, I want to do something better. And then do you think this does have ebbs and flows with the generations, like how in the 1980s and 1990s comic book movies could not be taken seriously by the mainstream, whereas now they seem to be the mainstream?
Every good idea should definitely feed on those that kind of come before it. I mean, there's that whole idea of these ebbs and flows that you're talking about and the influence of things. And it's not just, you know, seeing a movie and having that inspire you. I mean, something like, you know, A Stranger in a Strange Land coming out in 61. I mean, that kind of fueled so many different ideas that were already kind of percolating, and just, you know, being able to take science fiction and apply it to more of the youth culture, that kind of stuff. And that's, you know, early 60s going into, you know, later 60s and everything. So, but yeah, I'm trying to think of what science fiction was like in the 1990s, because I definitely know that when we get into something like The Matrix, I mean, that again was taking a lot of ideas that were already pre-existing and kind of, you know, mixing them up. I mean, just using Yuen Woo-ping as the fight coordinator and everything, and pulling in a lot of the Hong Kong action stuff that we had seen earlier in the 90s into that style of filming, and then, you know, adding the science fiction elements onto it. So I'm trying to think of where you're coming from with like the goofy science fiction in the 90s. I'm sure there's tons that I'm not thinking of right now, but I'm just trying to figure out where you're coming from.
For that, for the 90s, it was a lot of the TV stuff. Sci-fi on TV, and this hadn't gone to cable yet, so this was still relatively network, was goofy pre-X-Files, really. It was like CBS's Space Rangers. I liked the show. It was an adult-themed show that was shot like it was made for 14-year-olds. And you had things like that where you had the network TV stuff, which kind of said, well, Max Headroom didn't work, aimed at an adult audience. Let's aim a little bit lower because they're the people who are going to see the new Star Trek movies and the people that are going to all these sci-fi movies. Because other than horror, which might be the only thing that really gives it a run, science fiction has always been a box office winner, yet has always been kind of the on the low scale of the critical end when it comes to movies. People, oh, that sci-fi stuff, oh, that horror stuff. Like how Paramount was always ashamed of the Friday the 13th movie series, despite that being some of their biggest moneymakers throughout the 80s. They were always ashamed of it. 20th Century Fox didn't even give Star Wars a push. They literally sold it. Go back and look at the first trailer. They sold Star Wars as a kids movie. They sold this to 14 to 17-year-olds. You know, it was like this idea that science fiction is not for adults. If you want that, then you go and read Frederick Pohl and Heinlein and Ellison. But movie science fiction is for kids.
Kind of like video games now, even though they are some of the biggest moneymakers out there going with science fiction stuff. Science fiction movies are almost always some of the biggest moneymakers out there, but there's still just the notion that, oh, it's kid stuff. Oh, only kids go to see that. And it's ridiculous because time and time again, it's proven that that's not the case, that there are people of all ages that love good science fiction and, you know, to that extent, video games. But science fiction has good science fiction has always had mass appeal. And sometimes maybe it doesn't do well theatrically for whatever reason, bad marketing or it released at the wrong time.
In all honesty, I'm surprised Star Wars made the money it did. Those early trailers and TV spots were terrible. They did not sell the movie well at all.
Well, they were too busy selling Damnation Alley. Like, that was the big movie that Paramount was pushing. And then it was Paramount, right? 20th Century Fox. Brain farted there. Yeah, 20th Century Fox was too busy pushing Damnation Alley because they sunk so much money into it. Oh, yeah, we got this other movie coming out. And then, you know, Star Wars ended up being massive and saved the studio from going bankrupt because they sank so much money into Damnation Alley.
I don't know. It feels like we're kind of hopping all over the place here, especially going from, you know, we're talking so many different types of media, talking about books, comic books, video games, movies, television shows. And it's like every media has its own high points and low points, and sometimes they coincide and sometimes they don't. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with a lot of these points as far as, you know, science fiction being poo-pooed or video games or anything. I mean, video games are probably the most viable economic investment going right now. I mean, Amazon just plunked in, like, I don't know how many millions of dollars to buy a channel where you can watch people play video games. So
$960 million.
Yeah, so there's big bucks going on here, so I don't see this as being ghettoized, you know, and so I'm just having a little bit of a hard time wrapping my head around where we're coming from with this stuff. And I'm thinking, like, oh, science fiction wasn't good on TV in the 80s and 90s. Well, that's when Next Generation was on. So, you know, and then also we're kind of mixing genre lines, talking about horror with the X-Files, right, versus science fiction. So
I think the X-Files qualifies as both horror and science fiction, honestly, depending on what they were doing that week.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. But then I think to myself, it's like, okay, well, X-Files wouldn't have existed without Kolchak back in the early 70s. So it's like, it's again that kind of feeding upon itself. Now, Kolchak didn't last for very long, but there were also, it's like kind of the zeitgeist thing where you had the, you know, the Norlis tapes and all these different things happening all at once back then, and it just kind of took a little while for it to all kind of catch up and catch on. I mean, but there have been paranormal investigators, you know, throughout pretty much the, you know, other than, you know, we can talk about going back all the way to the murders in the Rue Morgue and everything. So it's like there's these threads, and it just takes a while for things to kind of catch up and catch on and, you know, hit that nerve with the, you know, the pop culture. So well, I don't know.
Like one of the things I'm thinking of is like V, the original V miniseries in 1983. How Kenneth Johnson sold that series to NBC was there was no science fiction element at first. He just wanted to make a contemporary telling of It Can't Happen Here, of the rise of modern fascism in 1983 America. And he could tell during the pitch meeting that he was losing the executives. They started doodling and whatnot, and he could tell he was losing them. And he's like, "But okay, so it's the rise of Nazis, but the Nazis are from space." He said he literally saw their eyes light up. Some of them picked their head up like, "Yeah, yeah." And then how it was finally sold, how he had to sell it was, you have the fascism, It Can't Happen Here angle for mom and dad, and this is the part, and the sci-fi element to get the kids. That it was still, the sci-fi is for the kids. Like that kind of thing. I don't know if you'd be able to sell V that same way today.
I honestly think that if they would have done V the way that he wanted to do it, it would have been a miniseries, and then that's it. But because of the science fiction angle that they put in there, and it was so just cool at the time, like I don't know, it really hit a nerve, and I watched it then, and I still love it. You know, even the TV, you know, you know, one season TV series that came after the two
worthless after Michael Ironside quit.
Well, I wouldn't
the
say
Star
worthless.
Child really bothered me. And that's why I quit.
Cook, yes.
Well, the Star Child, but I mean, she was at, you know, the end of the final battle. So
but she was the main character in the TV show, played by Jennifer Cook.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, what I'm saying is that it didn't. I don't know. It didn't ruin it for me. But I mean, yeah, definitely the show could have been stronger. But it never really got a chance to. But at least they gave it a full season. That was back when, you know, a show they would at least give it a season before they'd cancel it. Now two episodes in, they'll can it. I just think that that's the thing. Had they have not added the science fiction angle, it would have come out. It would have been a miniseries, and it would be promptly forgotten.
You know, if you miss V, and I know that there was that horrible remake of it a little while ago.
I gave up three episodes into that one. That entire thing was an indictment of the Obama administration. It was nice. So paper thin that it annoyed me.
Well, right now, I mean, they're still showing Falling Skies, and basically that has turned into V. So if you miss V, go back. I mean, this season they have the Star Child again. So
seriously? Really, yeah. I watched the first two seasons, and really, they went, like, supernatural, and that's disappointing, Mike. Thanks for ruining my night.
Yeah, no problem. I quit watching it about three, four episodes ago, because I couldn't hack it. So, again, cyclical. Same idea as just kind of being repackaged and called something else. So, as far as V goes, I mean, I didn't know any of the backstory to it. I was in fourth grade when it came out, and I just remember the day after, what was her name, Diana, after she ate the rat. I mean, the whole school was just a Twitter talking about that scene. I mean, we were all watching V at the time.
I watched that first run too, but then, like Mike, you brought up the kind of, you're relabeling it or calling it something else. This goes back to my initial question of, like, the stigma, like how horror, the term horror, has a stigma when it comes to critics, and especially to, like, the Academy Awards and whatnot. Until the last couple of years, horror films rarely, if ever, got nominated for Academy Awards. And when they did, for instance, when Silence of the Lambs was up for all of those awards in 91, MGM went out of their way to tell people this is not a horror film. It's a suspense thriller.
How do you get all your friends to get baptized just so you can make a monster movie?
It's not a monster movie. It's a supernatural thriller.
They even got mad at Fangoria for calling it one of the best horror films of the year. An MGM representative was like, no, it's not horror. That, like, horror has this stigma that no. This is for adults. This is not a horror movie. This is a suspense thriller.
I have to disagree with you again, because the Academy Awards in 1969, I mean, Ruth Gordon won for Rosemary's Baby, and the screenplay was nominated.
And The Exorcist. I mean, it does happen, but rarely. I don't know.
I think you're casting this wide net, like, oh, it's so stigmatized. And I think it's kind of bullshit where you're coming from.
That's fair enough. You don't have to agree with me, Mike.
Good. I don't.
What about you, Cecil? Do you agree with me or Mike?
It's either one or the other. You're either.
You don't get a middle ground, damn it. I agree with myself.
This is the George Bush tactic.
Either you're with us or against us.
I don't negotiate with whites.
I will say that horror has weird assertions that come up. In general, there are horror fans, and they're looked upon as hardcore horror fans. But when the weird things will happen, like when Saw came out and then Hostel, and then all of a sudden people started attributing them as torture porn. These movies are nothing more than torture porn. When really, if you go back and watch the original Saw, there's not a lot of violence in it, and it's more in your head than anything. Now, the later sequels did include more violence, and they kind of kept upping the ante, but
I think the later ones got gratuitous. I think that's the word you're looking
for. Yeah, the later ones got gratuitous. Not this quote-unquote torture porn that everybody is so freaked out about how they're pushing the envelope. They need to start going back and watching Audition, Flowers of Flesh and Blood. If you really want to see something that you are going to call torture porn, then watch something that is absolutely disgusting.
Grotesque.
I mean, Saw wouldn't have existed without Seven. To me, you know, it was just as I watched Saw the first time, I was like, boy, screenwriter really likes Seven a lot. But I will say, okay, coming at this from a different angle, I will say that there have been times where horror has really gotten a bad rap, especially thinking of like the early 80s, thinking about the whole, you know, oh, these kids who watch horror films go out and they shoot up schools or they shoot themselves in the head with shotguns, these kind of things. So I will definitely agree that there is a stigma attached to some of the fans, a snake eating its tail a little bit there as far as what is to blame. Is it the movies? Is it the kids? What is it? So there are times where the films will get this bad rap, and especially that seems to be the thing. Maybe we're getting past it. I doubt it. But there's always that whole what can we blame kind of thing. And other than Canada, a lot of times it is movies, it's the music, it's the video games, it's this whole, oh, they're being desensitized to violence and everything. I imagine that, you know, the same thing happened all the way back with, you know, the 10-cent plague and everything, with the blaming of the comic books for juvenile delinquency. So I will say that I agree with you that there is a stigma attached to these by certain elements in society.
Okay. Well, what about then when sci-fi, in the case I'm going to bring up, sci-fi TV, when it goes out, when it tries to hit an audience that might not want it? For example, Battlestar Galactica, the 2003 series. During the writer's strike a few years ago, Universal owns both NBC and the Sci-Fi Channel. And this being a Sci-Fi Channel original, they decided during the writer's strike to air Battlestar Galactica on NBC in prime time. And it tanked. The ratings were abysmal. The ratings were almost a quarter of what it got on Sci-Fi. So after 3 or 4 weeks, they moved it off of NBC and back to the Sci-Fi Channel, where the ratings went up precipitously. The Sci-Fi Channel only has a limited reach. NBC has a nationwide reach. Why would the ratings be worse on the network that can get it out the largest? It was almost like the fans said, I don't know, Battlestar Galactica doesn't feel right on NBC. I'll watch it on Sci-Fi.
I have no idea why that would be the case.
That's what happened.
I don't know why. No opinion. I still feel very cheated by Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, that ending. Yes.
Yeah.
Cecil hasn't seen it yet, so don't wreck it for him.
I know, I'm a little late. Between that and Lost, I was just like, please just take a shit in my mouth. I'll accept that more than you dicking me around for 5 years and then doing this to me.
it's such an oddity. I think that probably the general public just, there are certain channels that certain fans just won't go to. Like I know me myself, the majority of the shows that I watch are not on 3, 6, and 10. And so there's the possibility that if a show that I was watching did make the move over, if I didn't know about it, like, I don't know, I may not have followed it over. So there's probably a lot of people that when Battlestar Galactica went to NBC or whatever, didn't realize it. You know, is it, hey, it's not on Sci-Fi tonight. All right. Because there's a lot of people that just won't change the channel. That's why a lot of the old networks used to have those blocks, the TGIF and all that, because they would put like the really popular show at the end of the night so that people would tune in at 8 o'clock and would watch through straight till 11. You know, because God forbids, you know, oh my God, they're going to change the channel. So I think that was probably it. It was a lot of people just didn't even realize that it went to a major network.
Yeah, they would have the hammock shows where it was, you know, you had Cosby Show at 8, you had Cheers at 9, so then something like A Different World could actually exist, you know, be at 8:30, because otherwise you throw that on at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, nobody's watching that shit. It was a horrible show, but because it's between two good shows.
NBC tried that in, 1988 with Beverly Hills Bunts, the Hill Street Blues spinoff. It went from an hour-long drama to a half-hour-long dramedy with no laugh track or anything, so they paired it with The Golden Girls. And you just go, I wonder why no one watched that Hill Street Blues spinoff on Saturday nights in the comedy block, right? But then you've got also the now major acceptance of comic books. Like, you know, comic books have gone mainstream, and I've bitched about this before, so this part's nothing new. I can't stand the fact that people will not call them comic books. They're graphic novels. That somehow, oh, I read graphic novels. And you see this in the marketing all the time. Based on the graphic novel of this, you go, that was 16 issues released through, you know, monthly for a year and a half. That's not a graphic novel. That's a comic book. Why can't you call it a comic book? Major comic book creators like Alan Moore and even Frank Miller pre-Insanity have come out against the term. That they're like, we write comics. What, where the hell is all this? Oh, no, it's a graphic novel. Where's all this come from? Is that sort of a, I would feel ashamed liking the Avengers as a comic book movie, but I can like it if it's based on a graphic novel.
I've always had a definitive difference. Like comic books, like I don't have any issue with saying, you know, comic books.
Any issue. I see what you did.
Hey, I didn't even realize that. Let's see what I did there, not even knowing. I don't have issue with saying comic books, but I have always gone under the guise that a comic book is a single issue. A compilation of issues is a
trade paperback.
A trade paperback, thank you. And a graphic novel is something like Watchmen or something like
Alan Moore has outright said Watchmen is a comic book. He got pissed.
Alan Moore is an asshole, though.
Well, so. he is, but since it's his creation, I think he has a little more weight to this. When I think it was Time Magazine released the 100 greatest novels of all time, and Watchmen was the only comic book on it, and they kept calling it a graphic novel. He's like, where are you people getting this? I'm a comic writer. I wrote a comic book. Knock it off.
I don't know. I think he's getting a little carried away. I'm fine calling them graphic novels, and it sounds a lot more mature than comic book. And I don't read comic books because I can't afford to buy single issues anymore. I mean, once they got up to a dollar, I quit buying comic books.
Damn, and that was now a while ago. Buy... They're like $2.95 now, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. So I will buy the occasional graphic novel or trade paperback. To me, those are interchangeable. So whatever. I mean, I think you're getting caught up on semantics there.
It's just one of those things that bugs me so much because
there are so many things that bug you, though, Josh.
Thank
That's
you.
Why I exist.
If you didn't say it, I was gonna.
I believe the term is comic book, not graphic novel. I'm not called graphic novel guy. My name is comic book guy.
I'm going to quote from Frank Miller again, pre-Insanity.
Oh, God.
Yes, I said pre-Insanity.
You're really bringing out all the big guns when it comes to a-hole artists.
I didn't bring up Terrence Malick once, or Mike White. But no, he said the difference between calling it a graphic novel or a comic book is the difference between a lady of the evening and a prostitute. They're the same thing, and you get to the same place. You just feel a little bit better about yourself for going to a lady of the evening than a prostitute. It's all about making the buyer feel better. It's all about people self-inflating their own. Because I've actually run into people that I don't read comic books. I read graphic novels. Yeah, then why do you have the newest Batman and Superman issues? They're graphic novels. No, they're not. Quit being pretentious. Do you think that how we have kind of changed, and by we I mean pop culture, has kind of changed the way people look at this stuff in general? And I mean the people who are not part of it. For instance, like your average Joe off the street. Like one of the things that Bonnie Hammer did when she ran Sci-Fi Channel into the ground, creatively, not ratings-wise, was she wanted to get rid of shows like Farscape because you had to remember what happened for the last six episodes to follow it. She wanted, and I'm quoting again, your average guy working at a construction site to come home and just be able to enjoy himself for a half hour watching our channel. What she was basically saying is these can't be smart because that requires continuity. That requires making the person think. She kind of wanted like Joe Sixpack to enjoy science fiction, and that's what she gave them with crap like Stargate SG-1 and some of the other Sci-Fi Channel originals. Do you think that you have to dumb it down to get the mainstream to like it, or just market it differently?
It's a weird science that goes into getting mainstream attention, because sometimes things that are really incredibly intelligent and well-constructed will just endear themselves into the mainstream. Look at Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad is a phenomenally well-written and well-acted, well-everything put together show, and it attained massive mainstream success, whereas something that is complete trash garbage like Desperate Housewives also achieves the same level of success. It's odd, you know. You never know what really is going to hit, because I mean, there have been a lot of amazing, well-constructed, well-put-together things that just fail miserably because they can't tack into the mainstream. Or get a niche going at all. Was she the lady who decided to bring in wrestling on frickin' Sci-Fi?
Yes, Bonnie Hammer wanted to make her ideal, and this is what I've gotten from insiders that I've interviewed and just from reading various interviews with people. She basically wanted a Sci-Fi channel for the everyman, not for the sci, because Sci-Fi Channel's ratings were stagnant. They weren't going down, but it was basically, we have the sci-fi audience and we can't survive off that. We need to now get people who don't watch sci-fi to start watching the channel. She's the one who also got rid of all the educational programming on that channel, because your average Joe Sixpack doesn't want to have to learn. He wants to watch shit explode and a bunch of oily men roll around on the mat with each other and scream at each other with their mouths open wide in a totally heterosexual way.
Ugh. Yeah, something like that. They don't get that consistency is so much better than explosive growth, because, you know, you'll have that burst and then, you know, after a little while, they'll go back to watching something else.
No, actually, I hate to say this, Bonnie Hammer was right. There's a reason she kept getting promoted. As she got rid of the hardcore sci-fi fans and started dumping all of the hardcore sci-fi shows, the ratings went up dramatically.
And stayed
from
up.
From an executive level, she made the right move. From a creative level, she drove the channel into the ground.
Well, I mean, then as much as it sucks and as much as, you know, you and I don't like it, then she did the right thing. It's terrible and it's awful and it really messed up what the channel was doing. But, I mean, it kept it on the air, I guess.
I mean, it's like History Channel and what, Travel, and I mean, all these channels that were supposed to be dedicated to one thing, and now it's like, you know, I mean, what the hell? Arts and Entertainment Channel is showing, I don't remember who plays Duck Dynasty, but it's on the wrong channel.
I think that is A&E. To me, the History Channel, and I love that both movies were on it, but I knew they were on a decline when History Channel showed The Road Warrior and Planet of the Apes in the same week. It kind of went, I don't remember that from history. Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, Yeah, it's just it's the sad state of you know, all this programming is just being kind of, you know, leveled rather than us having the ability to have these niche channels where it's like, you know, you want history, you go to the History Channel, you want biography. I mean, biography used to be the biggest program that they would show on A&E, and now it's like, who does that anymore? Nobody that I know of.
Used to have Behind the Music. Do they even still do that?
MTV used to show videos.
Yeah, you know? The culture changed, which to a degree I can say that's why. But I also think, like, using the Bonnie Hammer example, the only way she could find success was to dumb it down. Is that the way science fiction or the genre, with being fantasy and horror, should be accepted? I mean, you know, it kind of comes down to like Doctor Who. I don't watch modern Doctor Who, but I've seen it explode in popularity to the point where I start to go, these are the same people that 10 years ago would have never watched a 1985 Doctor Who episode, but because it's cool now, now it's okay for them. I almost see it as a little bit of hipsterism, both on my part and on theirs. Are you seeing what I'm seeing?
I'm trying to remember what the name of it was, but yeah, I know that, why can't I remember that little guy's name? Patton Oswalt has written extensively as far as this whole co-opting of geek culture. And yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, an Avengers movie is, you know, top box office. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy, number one film for 2014. 10 years ago, that would have been unheard of. You know, this whole idea of the way that Marvel has marketed itself and changed and, you know, adapted and all this. I mean, it's great that they have been able to do that. At the same time, I think that our culture has been moving towards that, you know, idea. I don't know if it's this kind of democratization of the internet kind of effect or what it is, but yeah, definitely.
Geek is cool, Mike.
Yeah, geek has become chic. So it's like, okay, you know, and now you're trying, you know, people get upset about that. They want to, you know, reclaim geek culture or at least different aspects of it. And there's always going to be those, you know, the niches out there where you can still enjoy yourself. You know, you can go back and, you know, say, well, Blake 7 was the real cool thing. That's where, you know, the cool kids should be watching that, or watching the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, not that shitty movie that was made a few years ago. So everybody's going to be able to still have their little piece, but it's going to make Josh Hadley really mad that geek culture has been co-opted by the mainstream.
There's a meme that I love. It's this really pretty girl, and she's holding up her hand, and her hand says nerd on it. And the meme is, I absolutely love Pokemon. And then at the bottom, my favorite one is the yellow animal. So so it's like, it is this weird thing where you get all these people that are now into stuff like Pokemon and Guardians of the Galaxy. Oh, I love these things. They're great. I never heard of them 5 minutes ago, but they're the greatest thing ever, and I've been a fan for years. So it is become the whole geek is cool, geek is chic, whatever. And it's weird because even though there is still this stigma of geeks that are they're in their parents' basement and they just you know, haven't shaved and they smell, but then there's
basically
also
your story.
Yeah, basically me. I'm living in my parents' basement and I smell, and despite the fact that I'm in my own house with my wife and kid. But the general the thought of the general populace is still geeks are losers. But then you look at the mainstream, and there are people that are kind of taking the hot topic approach of where it is cool to be this thing some people still look at as nerdy. It's a very weird thing to be in.
Fighting about who's the bigger nerd.
Yeah, well, and to a degree, I realize I am kind of a I don't want you in my club kind of guy. But to me, it was more special when you discovered this stuff, when it wasn't mainstream, because as we pointed out with like the Bonnie Hammer example on that, when it goes mainstream, it becomes watered down. And I think that hurts the entire genre as a whole. And you may or may not disagree with me. I think something like being, you know, a hardcore Trekkie is something that really doesn't belong in the mainstream. And when it does get there, Yeah, Saturday Night Live, and that had their Star Trek parodies, and they did it right, and In Living Color had some really good ones. But in general, when you see like a Star Trek parody on a TV show, it's somebody who sampled two episodes and decided, yeah, now let's make fun of this because it's cool. I can't stand the because it's cool thing. And there are people who will yell and go, hey, it doesn't matter why they're reading comic books now. It doesn't matter why they're reading Guardians of the Galaxy. Just that they are, that should be the goal. I don't think just because it's cool should be the goal. Am I so out of touch, Mike?
Yes. You're becoming old man Josh.
You're older than me.
In my day, it was so much better. And no matter what, that's the what people 10 years older than us are saying, and that's what people 20 years older than us are saying. In my day, it was so much better. In my day, you only had three channels, so everybody watched the same damn programs, and we would all have the same conversations the next day around the water cooler. So, and now it's all fragmented. It's all ruined. So everybody has
damn
this
you
whole...
kids.
Yeah, it's so much better for me, that, and you kids have ruined it. So I don't know. I don't see, if you want your geek culture, if you want your cool stuff, it's out there. You just have to dig a little harder now.
I don't know. I think I realized that geek culture went too far into like the hipster area. When I see Tor Johnson's face on t-shirts and people that are like, oh, this is worse than an Ed Wood movie. Oh yeah, what Ed Wood movies have you seen? I don't know. I just heard he's like a really, really bad director. That's the kind of thing I'm seeing from today's youth. That's where I'm coming from.
Well, I mean, not to give myself a shameless plug, but that's one of the reasons why I started my show, was to go into the misconceptions of things. Like, there are so many people that are, oh, that movie is the worst movie ever. Oh, really? Did you see it? What didn't you like about it? Well, no, I never saw it, but I heard it was the worst thing ever. And there was this just general notion that if somebody heard it sucked, well, it automatically sucked. You know, they didn't have to bother to see it themselves to decide whether or not they perhaps liked it. That is kind of the thing that's been co-opted into just the mainstream, is that whatever the general populace thinks is what obviously is what it is. So with the Tor Johnson thing, I mean, God, you know, you can go to, you go to the mall, you'll see all this stuff from years ago that's now being made into hoodies. They're doing it because nostalgia is selling, even though they weren't around when it was going on.
It reminds me of, you know, you're in high school and you're enjoying, you know, your specific brand of music or whatever, and then you see the kid that comes in and he's wearing, you know, the brand new, you know, Sex Pistols t-shirt or whatever it is, and you're just like, oh, what a poser. And it's like, it's always going to be that way, you know. We're going to see, I mean, hell, I saw Domokun shit for sale at Target a couple weeks ago. Oh, okay, you know, I would like to have that stuff, that's really cool because I like Domokun. But it's like, you know, but now like little kids are, you know, carrying their books to school in Domokun, you know, knapsacks and stuff. It's like, okay, yeah, this really has reached the mainstream. So, you know, it's always going to be happening. All this stuff is always going to be bubbling up. And you know, when you see occasional nods here and there, it's like, okay, that's kind of cool. You know, like I'm trying to think, just the other day I was watching some kids show and they happen to make a reference to like a Lemon Party. And I'm like, okay, that's pretty funny. So
I've seen Mike, I brought this up on Scanners retrospective. I've seen an episode of Recess on Nickelodeon that had a Scanners reference.
Right.
Like, so what audience member gets that besides the dad?
And I love that kind of subversive stuff. But at the same time, it's that whole idea of, you know, if you saw that constantly, then it becomes, you know, being embraced by the mainstream. But if you just see that kind of subversive stuff in there, then it's like, okay, you know, catching references to the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam in the old Bullwinkle episodes, like these kind of things, it's like, okay, that's pretty darn cool. But then, you know, at some point it crosses the line, and I think the older we get, the less tolerant we are of that kind of stuff.
Well, I think it also does come to that kind of ironic thing. Because, like, I mean, I can't speak for either of you, but I'm going to assume you guys had similar experiences. When we watched, like, the old Universal flicks, especially the later ones from the 40s, or, like, Plan 9 from Outer Space and whatnot, we watched them because it was just a cool black and white movie and whatnot. Now they're watched because, oh my God, this movie is so bad, you have to see it. Now, Cecil, you have a movie, you have a show called Good Bad Flicks. Fair enough. On the other token, I don't like watching movies that are so bad they're good. Yes, if a movie turns out to be bad, it's bad. That's one of the reasons I avoid The Asylum. I don't get into the whole, oh my God, this movie has the worst effects I've ever seen. I'm loving it. I go, this movie has the worst effects I've ever seen. I'm turning it off. I think there is a certain irony that is lost on my bitter, crusty soul.
Well, I mean, I don't look at every single Asylum film and automatically love it. Actually, I dislike the vast majority of them because they are really poorly put together and bad special effects. You could tell that they're slapped together in like two weeks.
But in a way, that's what the audience wants, because look at like Sharknado. They right. made Sharknado 2 as bad as the first one because the audience loved how bad it was. In a way, it proffers an inferior product because the inferior product is more fun than if we made it good.
There does have to be a certain magical element there. It doesn't always work. And it fails more often than not. Like, I've seen a bunch of movies where they tried to be intentionally bad and they ended up just being bad. So there are ones that come along that are trying to be good, but through just sheer idiocy of the director.
It's
through...
more honest.
Yeah, that's the thing. And that's why they work. And that's why the movies like Birdemic and The Room and whatnot are so much, I guess you could say, better than the mm-hmm. ones that are trying to be bad. It's that they're bad, but they're trying to be good. And that's what makes them funny. And that's what makes them that you could watch them over and over again, is because there is an element of legitimacy to it. They weren't trying to make garbage. Sharknado, the first one, they weren't really trying to do a good, bad thing. They were just trying to make another Asylum film. And it happened to take off, because if you looked at all the movies that came out, I mean, there was Ghost Shark and all these other shark ones. And that just happened to be the one that caught mainstream attention. And so they decided to follow up on that with the sequel, which, surprisingly enough, they figured out the right way of putting it together and making another successful one.
That market out there, and, you know, they'll keep going on, and sci-fi will keep churning out these really bad movies. Occasionally, there's a diamond out in there. You know, I mean, there was one that I watched a few years ago called Mammoth that I liked a lot. And, you know, it had that right mix of self-awareness and cheesiness. So, I mean, I think there's some good ones here and there, but I totally agree with the whole idea of people that are more sincere tend to make the better bad movies. You know, Birdemic and The Room definitely stand out because they were just so completely wrongheaded and made for all the right reasons rather than just kind of cashing in, you know, doing snakes on a train instead of snakes on a plane. So things are just going to keep doing their going their way. I mean, before sci-fi was doing these, they were being thrown out onto home video. So the market's been there for a long time.
And see, I agree that the market has been there, and I just don't think it works when you go into the movie going, this movie is so bad it's good. Not to hit your title again, Cecil, but I don't agree that there are good bad flicks. Either it's a good movie or it's not. Maybe it has bad special effects and bad acting. To me, that still makes it a good movie. That doesn't make it a good bad movie. I've never liked that whole it's so bad it's good. I've always had problems with that circle back.
I wasn't, when I initially came up with it, I wasn't going with a so bad it's good, which I had found out, you know, in years subsequently of doing this, that was what the general perception was of the whole it's so bad it's good, which back in 2010, when I started this show, I mean, the so bad it's good thing wasn't really used anywhere near as much as it is now. I was going more upon the idea that these are good movies that are perceived as bad, which is why I went with good. Well, I originally was trying to do good bad movies, but somebody already owned the domain for that, so I went with good bad flicks. But as far as movies that are so good or so bad they're good, I think there are. I mean, God knows I've seen enough of them where I've gotten a vast amount of enjoyment out of them for all the wrong reasons. Like the remake of The Wicker Man is hilarious. The 2004 Catwoman is hilarious. They make fantastic comedies.
And see, I don't even look at like the Catwoman one like that. I look at that and go, this is an awful movie and I'm going to go do something else. Like, you know, file my fingernails into points and gouge my eyes out.
Thank you, guys. I think this has been a really nice conversation. It's been good to kind of go over all this stuff. So it's definitely been a lot of fun. And I think that I'm okay with a lot of the things that I like and have liked kind of coming out to life, to light, to the mainstream. It would be cooler if some of it was still my baby, but I'm okay seeing some of these things come out there because, you know, I never would have seen an Avengers movie or an Iron Man movie. I mean, when I was growing up, we had those horrible cartoons where they were just barely animated. So being able to see millions of dollars being thrown on screen and actual good movies kind of coming out of it, I'm okay with that.
We did get to see Reb Brown wearing a Captain America motorcycle helmet.
yes, we did.
And fight Christopher Lee.
Yeah. So like awesome. I said, I mean, Winter Soldier, I was totally on board with. So I definitely think that we have, to quote Virginia Slims, come a long way, baby.
Yeah, I agree with Mike. Actually, it was a pleasure talking to you again. And we haven't chatted, God, for months, the last time we had you on here. So it was nice chatting with you. But I think that in general, there are ebbs and flows with entertainment things. Science fiction will be popular now. Being a geek is popular now. Who knows where it's going to be in a couple years. Comic book movies are huge now, but there was a time in the 90s when disaster flicks, Twister, Dante's Peak, Volcano, all those movies were huge. And now, where are they? So what's popular now, 10 years from now, who knows what it'll be. So,
unfortunately, some of those have kind of morphed into science fiction movies. When you look at something like Man of Steel, where it's like, how can we destroy the city in a very different way?
Yeah, Cecil, I don't know if Mike agrees with me, but yeah, Man of Steel was a piece of crap. And I have seen it. I just hated it.
Well, I don't want to get into that bitch fest again. I think I presented my argument pretty well on that, and I know you know it but
you lost that argument.
No,
like a man.
I didn't lose the argument. I said we'll have to agree to disagree.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm
just losing the argument.
I didn't mean to touch a nerve. I was just bringing up the whole idea of
disaster movies
morphing into sci-fi or science superhero films.
No. But it's not an episode unless me and Josh disagree on something.
Okay.
Or actually,
of course you do, Cecil.
Disagree on several things.
Yes. So yes, I'm a curmudgeon. I'm a angry, crusty old man. But I just think this stuff, as it goes more mainstream, it gets dumbed down. And I think somehow we moved from sci-fi or the genre as kids stuff into it being taken seriously, and then now it's back to kids stuff to a degree again. And yeah, I know this episode was kind of all over the place, but you know, having a focused free balling episode, I think works. So where can we find Mike White projecting his booth?
I'm over at projectionboothpodcast.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at impossiblefunky.
What about Cecil T. Robot?
You can find me over at goodbadflix.com as well as geekjuicemedia.com.
And you can find my hipster ass at 1201beyond.com and contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. Just remember, guys, it's not cool just because it's cool. It's cool because it's good.
Think it's so important because you can vote. You own a guitar and you can play a note. Your 70s nostalgia is making me whine. And your chat, now it's our time. I'm really, really sensitive, it's a funny time. The world is crazy, my fear, when you saw 90s. I'm really sick of you and your questionable stubble. The better watch your back, cause you're in even trouble. You are the man, a 20-something dream, all the foot you play are super extreme.
Radio Drone is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.